A few weeks ago, I talked to Dr. Brian O'Brien in Perth about his studies of the dust, just published these 40 years later in the journal Nature. Here's more.
Your most recent publications is about the stickiness. Did you work out why the dust is sticky?
No, I didn't work out so much why it was sticky, but I analysed how its stickiness changed during the course of the lunar day as the sun rose. And for a vertical surface, which was facing sunrise on Apollo 12, it was very sticky when the sun was strongest. And for a horizontal solar cell, it was very weak when the sun was at sunset, but it got stronger during the day.
But this is what you've just published?
Yes.
Any response so far?
Yes, quite delightful responses. One of the guys from Kennedy Spacecraft Center just emailed yesterday saying it was most remarkable and most important and so on.
Any implications for another go on the moon when it might happen in, what, 10, 15 years' time if they do it?
Well, they're planning on 2020, and yes, there are very strong implications because you can't plan to manage the moon until you understand the physics of what makes it behave. And before you can understand the physics, you have to measure the facts of how it behaves. So we've jumped the first hurdle. I've got another two papers, one on the effects at sunrise, which is quite exciting when the sun comes up over the lunar horizon and that full power hits the little dust particles. They really get excited, photoelectron excited, become charged. And those can be fed in now to plan and design of the long-term stays, because the Apollo astronauts, not often recognised, the Apollo astronauts were only there early morning when the sun was only between 10 and 20 degrees above the horizon. So it's a tiny fraction of a lunar day, which is 28 times longer than an Earth day.
Otherwise they were in the module, were they?
Otherwise they're in the module, yep. Well, they're in the module during early morning as well.
Yes.
They landed and took off. Landed when the sun was about 10 degrees above the horizon, so that's very early morning, soon after sunrise. And they took off when it was only 20, 22 degrees, so that's still early morning.
If they'd had stayed for a couple of days, what would it have been like for them?
Well, according to the dust detector data, the stickiness would have been much greater, because the sun would have been overhead. Instead of hitting the sun's surface at angles of 20 degrees, it would be 90 degrees, the full bore of all the solar intensity. The ultraviolet and the X-rays would knock out the electrons more intensively.
After all these years, 40 years in fact, are you still in touch with any of the astronauts? Do you hear from Armstrong or Aldrin?
Not them, but I've been in touch with Alan Bean, who was the lunar module pilot for Apollo 12, the second mission, and he's very interested. He's a dour sort of Navy man, and his last message was, "Thanks, Brian, fine job."
Now I want to bring you to the tapes of presumably your work, boxes of them. They were brought from America when you returned here, is that right?
They were sent to me at the University of Sydney. Harry Messel kindly gave me a visiting professor job, as I'd had there earlier in 64, and we used Ciliac to read the tapes that were sent to me Air Express, one by one, from NASA.
That's the computer?
The computer tapes. Yeah, Ciliac, yes. Sorry. I keep forgetting the generation gaps. And Harry's delighted, of course, at all of this stuff, but the tapes were sent one by one through the Redfern Post Office, which initially thought that they were pornographic material, I think.
The University of NASA sent them by post, did they?
Air Express, yeah.
So you picked up this pornography at Redfern Post Office.
Well, we had to get it cleared first, but yeah, they got used to it after a while. And when I came across to Perth, my wife Avril and the kids kindly brought the 173 tapes across as household goods. And John DeLater at School of Physics at Curtin University kindly stored them for me until I found out just a couple of years ago that NASA had, quote, misplaced all their tapes. So these are the only tape records of all of the dust measurements on the moon for all of the Apollo missions.
11, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17?
The dust detector was only on 11, 12, 14 and 15. And one burnt up on 13.
Yes, indeed. And so you had them stored somewhere safe at the university, or was it back of a garage or something?
It was safe. John DeLater looked after them. I'm very happy with the way that they look today.
I heard that someone kind of lost track. I think John DeLater retired, and someone was wondering where they'd got to, and they went back to wherever it was and thought, oh, my gosh, I wonder if they're still there.
Well, the true sequence, somebody drew my attention to NASA's website in 2006, which said the tapes were misplaced. I contacted John and said, John, would you still happen to have those tapes? And he said, yes. And I went out there and we picked them up and stored them in a nice new environment at Spectrum Data, where they're all catalogued.
What had happened to the American ones?
They have made inquiries and they don't know.
So all that fantastic record of the science on the moon had disappeared in America?
No, only of the dust aspect.
Yeah, the dust stuff as well, but very important indeed. Then you had the problem of trying to read the tapes. What was that about?
The tapes were made for 7-track tape recorders, and they become obsolete. They're big refrigerator-style tape recorders, and NASA hasn't got any that work, and we don't have anything that works, and we're slowly advancing towards being able to read them. But, there's a big but, before I came across to Perth, I ran off about 100 plots from the computer of what I thought were interesting events, lunar module ascent and sunrise and all that sort of stuff. So I had 100 paper plots from which I then came to the conclusions in this latest paper in Geophysical Research Letters, so that I know that there's gold in them, their tapes, if you like, and that's been accepted. Now we can put a little bit more effort into getting them read again.
I heard, talking about reading them, that there is, in fact, a machine in Canberra that is capable of doing so and might be brought into service.
There was one in a museum in Sydney that was brought across to Perth, but it turns out that it'll take about a year and a lot of spare parts to get it fixed. So we're working at separate channels. It's a slow process.
When you've got it done, will America get a copy in some shape or form?
Yes, eventually I hope to put the data into the community access. The NASA National Space Science Data Center has got a setup for people to access the data themselves. But first of all, before we went to that effort, I needed to verify that the science was worth the effort, so to speak.
Well, clearly it is, and it reminds me slightly of the film The Dish, which told the story of how we brought those first steps by Armstrong and Aldrin walking on the moon because the other receivers had kind of packed up. And so it was Oz that made the whole thing work in terms of a public event.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, The Dish didn't go as far as the wonderful truth. Goldstone in California actually tried to transmit the first image of Armstrong coming down the steps to descend for that magic first step. But the boys in Australia said, hey, would you throw this switch because he's coming down head first? They had him upside down. But those, the slow scan video, which was made in Australia, the high-quality one, it also has been misplaced. The fellows at Honeysuckle Creek have been mounting a worldwide search for that for several years.
Makes you wonder about the scientists as these phenomenal events take place. You'd expect someone to say, well, something so valuable must be preserved. How can these things go missing? Do you just have too much stuff?
Well, you've got a tendency to rewrite over tapes. There's something like 700 tonnes of tapes. These are 10-inch tapes, weighing a couple of kilograms and so on. They're hard to miss, but they're expensive and the budgets were cut. Once Apollo 11 landed, the entire Apollo program was somewhat suffering from postpartum blues. It was very hard to get the rigour and the enthusiasm persisting through the rest of the missions.
Yes, 17 was not supposed to be the last one, was it? It was, in fact, cut short at the programme at 17 in 1972.
Yep.
And so many useful experiments. Did you have any experiments that didn't fly as a result?
No, I had one that went the wrong way. I had two on Apollo 13, which, of course, burnt up in the atmosphere.
With Tom Hanks aboard.
A beautiful movie. The only scary movie I've seen where you know the ending, but it's still scary. But I did propose to NASA more advanced dust detectors once I discovered what happened on Apollo 11 and 12. In 1969, in fact, the University of Sydney made a proposal to NASA, but they said that there were no funds for second-generation science within the Apollo mission. That was a real tragedy, that there wasn't scientific response during the course of the six missions. And that was inevitable because the astronaut safety was primary and everybody was still learning. A lot of the science had to be built and stored away for a couple of years before flight, just for engineering reasons and so on. So I hope that science and engineering will be much closer together on the new missions to the moon.
Looking back 40 years later, what do you think scientifically it meant, first of all to Australia and then to the rest of the world?
Well, it gave the necessary drive towards miniaturisation of electronics and all sorts of sophisticated things, that not just Teflon for your kitchen fry pan and whatever, but God help me, mobile phones are an outgrowth of that. So you've got your pluses and you've got your minuses. But it gave a drive, but primarily it was a psychological effect in the midst of the Cold War. It gave an enormous boost to education. The whole concept of knowledge being important came to the fore again, as it did after World War II.
And to Australia?
Australia, the advice given to Prime Minister Menzies in the 60s when I was trying to get Australian space science going, and presumably advice since, was satellites are not here to stay. So neither was Brian. I went back to America.
But also the fact that we were absolutely crucial in Australia because of sheer geography in terms of tracking and building up sophisticated technology so that we could be an equal part of that wonderful adventure.
Well, that's still all true. But think of the documentation of that is primarily in a satirical, delightful movie called The Dish. We wasted an enormous array of talent, people that had worked in American space research, European space research. We really haven't done what we should have done so many times.
To make a space effort of our own.
Yeah, or even to integrate our space effort more successfully and more forcibly into the global space research. I mean, the adventure to the stars and the rest. Bits are being done, but the Aussie talent for improvisation, whether it's in the dish or the dust detector, is something that is lacking in the big machines of the more developed countries, the individualism and all the rest of it. And that's a talent, that's a unique contribution we can make, as Honeysuckle Creek and the others have made, Parkes and Dubbo and the rest. But Parkes was a CSIRO radio physics research unit, you know, that piggybacked on the space program. My dust detector was so small, it piggybacked on the others. But, you know, we'll get there.
I was with Dr. Brian O'Brien, space scientist in Perth.